he's on yet. Good evening, everyone, and let me welcome you to the LSE. My name is James Kerr-Lindsay. I'm a visiting senior fellow at LISI, which is the research unit on Southeast Europe that we have in the European Institute. It really gives me great pleasure to welcome our guest this evening, Matthew Kidd, who has just retired as the British High Commissioner in Cyprus. Matthew and I just were having a chat upstairs before coming down and sort of reminiscing about some of the more recent events in Cyprus. And it really is true to say that I don't think there's another official in the British government who is really so immersed in Cyprus as Matthew. I'll read out a short bio in a minute, but just to say, you know, I think we would saying you'd said you had done an unprecedented three stints in Cyprus over the course of your career, and the last two had actually been in relative close succession to one another. So really, Matthew has been the British representative for the best part of the last decade on the island. And of course, it's been an amazing period of time to have been on the island. You know, when Matthew arrived, we were about 6 years out from the Annan plan, and there were real questions about where settlement hopes were going to go. And of course, over the past few years, we saw a great build-up of hope and expectation with the United Nations effort to try and resolve the division on the island, which came to a head last July in Crans-Montana, where Matthew was obviously one of the key people involved in that process. But of course, we're also at a very interesting point in Britain's relationship with Cyprus. As some of you might know, my family has been on the island for almost 30 years, and like many others, have a real question about where the relationship between Britain and Cyprus is going in the context of Brexit. What will this mean for the large British community on the island? People often forget that there's a lot more to the relationship between Britain and Cyprus than simply the Cyprus issue and the question of the bases. And so really, to address all these points, I think it's going to be fascinating to hear what Matthew has to say. By way of background, Matthew is a former British High Commissioner to Cyprus, as I mentioned. He began his career at the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in 1878. Anyone versed in Cyprus would know that you see 78 and you automatically think 1878 when Britain took control of the island. So it's sort of 1978, and took up his first posting to Cyprus in 1980. He was later posted to UK diplomatic missions in New York, Paris, Ethiopia, Germany and NATO before returning to Cyprus as British High Commissioner from May 2010 to August 2014, and again from June 2016 until his retirement just last month. Matthew attended Oxford University, where he read languages. Matthew.
Thank you, James. Thank you very much. It wasn't 1878, I do insist on that. But it's true that my career has been a bit unusual in that I have spent so much of it in and working on one place. Before I left, I was surprised at how many people said to me, "You're going to write a book about Cyprus, aren't you?" I'm not going to write a book about Cyprus. By the time I had done so, everything that I knew would be well in the past and nobody would want to read it. So you, in a sense, get the chance tonight to hear what I might have said, might have written if I had written a book. I've had my share of pretty pungent criticisms sometimes during my time in Cyprus. I've been called a colonialist hangover. It has been suggested that I ought to be expelled. It's all part of the business of being British High Commissioner. But I've also had my good faith doubted, which, to be honest, has hurt a bit more sometimes. On the other hand, though, I have often been encouraged, walking around next year at the weekend, by people stopping me in the street and saying good things about how they believe I have tried to help Cyprus find a way forward. So I think I feel entitled to make an assumption that over my 10 years nearly there, I have proved my commitment to supporting a good future for Cyprus. I have shown my goodwill. And so, as James says, I'm about to stop, about to leave the Foreign Office, have just left Cyprus. And I think I'm going to dare to assume that on the basis of that demonstration of commitment and engagement and goodwill, it's open to me to play, if you like, the role of honest friend and say some things about what I think I've seen about both the settlement process and the bilateral relationship, which you need friends to tell you from time to time, but which the friend in question always needs to hold his breath and hope that the friendship is going to survive it when he does so. Yes, or do I need to sit closer to something? Does that help? Yeah. Okay. If I bring that closer to me. Yeah. Okay. So I will touch on both those things, and then I will, if you don't mind, finish, since probably this is the last sort of public event I shall participate in before I retire. I will give you a few final thoughts on what I think I have learnt about what diplomacy is and how to do it. And then if you think that there are things that you would like me to have talked about that I haven't, we can, I guess, have time for that afterwards. Yep, good. Starting with settlement, I'm not going to retrace the steps of the process that I've seen over the last 8 years on and off. I think it's true that that process, with its ups and downs, with its frustrations, made a lot of progress, and that potentially still that progress could be translated into a complete settlement. But I don't think that's really what's most useful. It's perhaps more useful to try to draw a few lessons about why the things that didn't come out as well as we would have wanted them to, what went wrong, what got in the way, and to use that, if possible, as a basis for suggesting how, even at this late stage, it could be possible to achieve a better result. One of the most depressing things in working on a Cyprus settlement is when you hear people say, what's the point of repeating the same actions again and again and again and expecting a different result? That's so disappointing and cynical and unconstructive that I think the better result, the better approach, is to look at why the things that you've tried to do haven't worked so far and what you might be able to do to get somewhere different another time. And I can say that because I can say quite honestly, I am a believer in the value of a Cyprus settlement. I make no bones about that. Not absolutely any settlement, but there is a broad range of possible settlements which would be good for Cyprus and good for the region in which Cyprus sits. So that's my starting point, which means that I have had the good luck over the last years to be doing a job which demanded from me that I try to help achieve a settlement, and luckily demanded of me, therefore, that I try to achieve something that I believed was a good thing to try to achieve. Not everybody gets that all the time, but I have had that in Cyprus, and I think that's really important to bear in mind. And there are lots of well-known reasons presented for why a settlement would be in the interests of Cyprus, and I think they all more or less have validity. They're all a little bit speculative by definition, but I think they're all sensible. But the thing, in a sense, that most motivated me to believe that a settlement would be a good thing for Cyprus was the sense of, if you like, the planning blight. All the things that Cyprus isn't doing, has put off doing until there is a settlement. All the gradual evolution of economic and social and educational policies that most countries do, legislation, legislature by legislature, Cyprus has very often said, we need to come back to that, but the first priority is settlement. For perfectly good reasons, but as the years go by, the effect of that choice, that planning blight, is that in some ways Cyprus starts to fall behind. And you'll all have seen the figures that the OECD produces on the quality of education in Cyprus, as one example. There are other examples as well. Another particular example that the UK got involved with is the way in which staying close to what the constitution provides in terms of a judicial structure, judicial system, has meant that it takes longer in Cyprus than anywhere else in the EU to settle cases. And that has a direct economic cost and a direct social cost as well. So it's not a criticism to say any of that. There are perfectly good reasons why it has made sense, it has seemed to make sense, to put some parts of governmental evolution on hold until a solution has been reached. But as the years go by, the cost of doing that becomes greater. So I think there's a really important time factor to bear in mind in looking at settlement. We're used to, if you like, the parties focusing on the tactical time factor, whether or not it is a good thing to have your negotiation process structured in any kind of tight time-bound way. That's one kind of issue. But there is a longer-term strategic issue relating to time, which is that the opportunity costs may grow the longer you allow a settlement to be delayed, and some of the aspects that you have to settle may inherently become more difficult as time goes by. And the property chapter is one obvious example of that. So it's really important, I think, to have in mind not just the tactical choices about how you structure the timing of a negotiating process, but the strategic alteration that gradually happens as you let time go by. Take that thought a stage further. It's not surprising, I think, that 40 plus years into the effort, the recurrent effort to achieve a settlement based on the high-level agreements of 1977 and 1979, it's not surprising that after so long, people start to ask themselves, maybe we're trying to achieve the wrong kind of settlement. If it's taking so long, maybe that's because we've set ourselves the wrong exam question in the first place. Not surprising, but that kind of questioning needs to be very carefully focused on the right things. It may well be that the reason why it's taken so long is not that the questions are wrong, but that the methods for trying to answer the questions have not been as effective as we would all have liked. And three examples that I'd like to mention of aspects of that which I think are worth thinking about. It's very tempting to think that the search for a settlement in Cyprus is about correcting past wrongs. Of course, that's where it starts, but correcting past wrongs as an objective in itself doesn't create much by way of positive incentives for the future to lubricate a settlement. It doesn't create the possibility of saying, if you give me this, I will give you that, and the result will be that in the future we will all have a better Cyprus to live in. If all you're doing is trying to get back to a increasingly nostalgic, maybe in some cases misremembered past, then you deprive yourselves of the opportunity of creating a positive incentive for your negotiations. So that's one thing to think about. I think there's a really important difference, which doesn't seem to get explored very much, between a Cyprus settlement and a Cyprus solution. People tend, the media tend, to use the two terms pretty much interchangeably, thank you very much. But actually they're really different, and the difference between them is fundamental to what this whole challenge is about. A settlement is the result of a process of discussion, compromise, creativity, which leads you to a result which both sides, or all sides, depending on however many there are, accept is good enough to provide a basis for moving forward. It's not claiming to be a magic solution. It's not claiming to give everybody all that they want, but it is a result which is good enough. And then, in the case of Cyprus, the expectation is that the voters on both sides would get their chance to decide, to vote on whether it is good enough. A solution is something much more ambitious. And in practice, a solution, which I take to mean something like a situation where the origins of the conflict, the origins of the problem, no longer apply, is likely to take a much longer period of time to reach. A settlement is probably a key stage on the way to a solution, but you probably can't get to a solution without going through a settlement first. So when people think about what the result of the negotiations could potentially be, in practice, probably what they are doing is talking about what a settlement could look like, what compromises could be offered and accepted in order to create a settlement, on the basis of which, with a lot of hard work and determination from all sides, a solution could eventually emerge. It's not about creating a solution from the beginning. Third point, there are all sorts of different ways of conducting negotiations, all sorts of different styles of negotiation, and there's nobody who can say that one style is right or wrong for a given kind of situation. But if the fundamental requirement in any negotiation, in order to make it work at all, is that you have to make your interlocutor believe in your readiness to do a deal, then there are things that you can do to help create that belief, and there are things that you can do that risk weakening that belief. And things like when you offer whatever flexibility it is that you have to offer in order to get a response, in order to move forward, that's a really important tactical thing. Things like what you say outside the negotiating room about what you're doing inside the negotiating room. That too is really important. And there's no single answer to how best to do that. You could say that EU member states on the way to any of the big answers to the big problems over the years, on the way, they always say publicly how tough they're going to be, how little room for manoeuvre they have, in order to try to strengthen their position, to get the other side to offer more to them in order to get something back. But it is risky, because then you can get to a stage where you do manage to achieve a settlement of the kind that we've just been talking about, but it is less than what you have been saying in advance you must have in order to agree. So then you have a problem with your own voters afterwards. So that too needs to be thought about. And that is, in a sense, I think the final point I wanted to make about the settlement process, if you like. It's very risky, I think, to test your voters too far. There are lots of ways of doing that, but in the end, particularly in a case like Cyprus, where it is set up so that they will have the last word, you have to be really careful not to stretch their credulity too far on the way. And one of the ways in which you risk doing that is by talking in terms of slogans without really explaining what they are. And it's easy to do that in on a topic which everybody is so familiar with. You think you can talk in the shorthand. You think you can talk about double zeros. You think you can talk about this and talk about that. But actually, each time you do that without explaining to the voters whose support you will need in the end, what it is that you're actually talking about and why it's so important and what you have done to relate one particular thing that you're referring to in this shorthand way to other aspects of the overall deal, you are making it harder for them to see the overall picture and to understand the substance underlying the slogans. In the same way, it's very tempting sometimes to think that there are magic answers available. And some politicians who don't necessarily win elections but who campaign on them will try to tempt their voters into believing that if they were in charge, they could wave a wand and it would all work out fine. And that is really dangerous in terms of creating the possibility of voter cynicism. Because if they get the chance to wave their magic wand and they wave it and nothing happens, voters' trust in them will be damaged. And voters' trust in what they are trying to achieve and why they are trying to achieve it and what is achievable will be damaged. And so in the end, you make it less likely that if you can get to the stage where voters have the chance to vote on something, you've achieved a deal, you make it less likely that they will be able to treat it in its own terms as a serious one, because what you have told them about it on the way has been so misleading. So all that, in a sense, to say that politicians who say to their voters that there are easy answers to the Cyprus problem should know by now that after however many decades, there aren't any easy answers, or they would have been found. Whatever solution, whatever settlement can be achieved will be the result of hard work, hard negotiation, hard graft, hard compromises, hard choices. But, as I say, I believe that it is still a task worth pursuing and a task that is achievable. So I hope that that is a challenge that both sides will soon want to come back to in an active way. So I'll leave the settlement there. just a few things about the bilateral relationship, which is, I think I can say, in a better state now, probably, than at any stage since 1960. And I don't want to say that to kind of to crow. I certainly don't want to say it without touching wood. But I think there are a few lessons that it's worth taking about how it has come to that state, so that, if possible, we can all avoid falling back from it by failing to recognise what we've done right and risking doing the wrong things instead in the future. I think that one of the easiest positive developments has been that, particularly, but not just, since Cyprus acceded to the European Union, Cyprus and the UK have discovered that across the whole range of the EU's business, particularly the business that Coreper One does, the two countries, to a really quite surprising degree, find themselves on the same side of the argument, voting the same way. Just after the Brexit referendum in the UK, then Foreign Minister Kasoulidis told me that the Foreign Ministry had done a bit of research and they had calculated, Solon knows this, that in over 90% of the votes in Coreper One, i.e. the EU, the parts of EU business that are done by qualified majority voting, not by unanimity, over 90% of those cases, Cyprus and the UK had been on the same side of the argument. And I think the discovery for both of us that we were like-minded, we were pushing for the same things, we did want to see the EU developing in the same broad direction, was a real revelation to both of us, and a really positive one. And I think we've seen it in a broader range of areas as well, but that is one very specific example, and I think it has made a huge difference to the way that we think about each other, the way that we talk to each other. I think it's also true, and this is maybe something that's more action by the British side than the Cypriot side, I think we have got better at recognising that we need to explain, we need to show respect for the other's view. We need to recognise that there are sensitivities that have to be taken into account. And I think that for too long, probably, in the years, let's say the first 40, 50 years after independence, we were a bit slow to do that on the UK side. And I think, as James said earlier, for too long we allowed it to look as though, we the UK allowed it to look as though Cyprus was of interest to us because of settlement, because of the bases, because of the treaties, but not for that wider range of shared interest that we've since discovered. So that too, I think, is something that on our side we have learnt, and I hope that we don't fall back from it. I think we've also, in the same period, learnt a bit together to recognise that the world outside is changing, is evolving. Cyprus is in a vulnerable region of the world. That creates new areas of shared interest, but it also creates new challenges in terms of the 1960 settlement. And I think that one of the things that we have done is that we have got better during that period at showing that we recognise some of those changes, and we are ready to try to evolve our own engagement with Cyprus to move with the times. And the classic example of that, if you like, is the agreement that we were able to reach now 4 years ago on allowing more flexible development of land within the bases for non-military purposes. You know, from 1960 onwards, the principle was that that wasn't allowed, but that became increasingly frustrating for Cypriot landowners inside the bases. And when in about 2005 we first started talking about that, the British side were very resistant to making any change. But gradually we showed that we got the point. We recognised we were not trying to be dog in the manger about it. We were ready to adjust our own approach to respect, to acknowledge that this was a problem for the landowners, for Cypriot landowners, and we were able, just over 4 years ago now, to reach an agreement to allow that to go ahead, to in effect to incorporate all the land within the bases outside the strict military areas into Cyprus's own planning guidance system, to enable that part of the island to become less unlike the rest in terms of what landowners there could do with it. And that's important. And I think finally, and maybe this is a good example of that too, I think we, again it's something that applies more to us, but not just to us, we have learnt during that period that a bit of doing, however hard it is, however frustrating it is, however demanding it is worth a lot of saying when it comes to proving our readiness to help and support. And maybe the best demonstration of that was the year before, in 2013, at the time of the economic crisis. We didn't just say, we're with you, we support you in your time of need. We found a very senior Treasury team to come out to Cyprus to be used by the government to help them prepare their negotiations with the Commission, the Troika, the IMF and others in areas that they had very little experience of, not surprisingly, but we, as it happened, had a bit more. And we didn't just, as I say, we didn't just tell them how much we supported them, we actually did something about it. And we did it quickly, and we did it in a time when, I think, many Cypriots felt that some of their other traditional international friends were not offering them support, the practical, active, doing support that they had been hoping for. But all those four things sound pretty obvious, pretty straightforward. And maybe, as I say, actually, the surprising thing is that it took us so long to wake up to them and to start to implement them. But I think they have made a difference, and I hope that the representative of the High Commission sitting here from the other side would not disagree with that general picture. And I hope that between us all, on both sides, we can learn those lessons and make sure that we don't fall back into bad ways from before. And as James says, some of the challenges that will come with British departure from the EU next year will put some of that under a new kind of stress. But I think, and I hope, that we're better placed now to meet that and to go with the flexibilities that will require than we would have been a few years ago. So finally, I learnt, I guess, most of what I know about diplomacy in Cyprus. Certainly all that I know about bilateral diplomacy, though I've done time in NATO and in the EU as well, so a bit of multilateral elsewhere. And I just wanted to offer you four quick lessons that I have learnt about what diplomacy is. And I do that not because I think that diplomacy is something that diplomats do. Diplomacy is a kind of approach to dealing with problems. And diplomats can apply it, and politicians can apply it, and parents can apply it in the family circle. all sorts of people can apply, but they are lessons about how to approach problems, which I hope are helpful. And I think the first one is, to go back to what I was just saying, saying is not diplomacy. Doing is diplomacy. Any number of people can tell you how much they back you, how much they think that you're saying the right things. But that doesn't actually solve anything. It's the doing that makes all the difference. And as I say, from my point of view, I've been glad that my career has, on the whole, provided me with more opportunities to prove the doing part than the saying part, because I think that's better. I think the second point, and maybe it's a bit more controversial, is that diplomacy is not about the application of international law. International law provides the framework, necessarily, but diplomacy needs to come into play at the point where the law itself can't take you any further. And it's obviously important that your diplomatic effort stays within the provisions of international law, but if you just stick with what law tells you the right answer is, you probably won't ever get to implementing that right answer. You need diplomacy to create the conditions going beyond the basis of law to find an answer. I think it follows also from that that diplomacy is not about defining winners and losers. If you look back, for instance, at the experiences of peace treaties after the First and Second World Wars, the First World War, Treaty of Versailles 1920, whenever it was, had too much about it of fixing Germany as the loser and punishing it for having lost. And we all know what happened. The approach taken in 1945, after the Second World War, was quite different. It wasn't able, at that stage, to reintegrate Germany as a part of the international system, but the aim, broadly, was to recreate the conditions in which a different kind of Germany could, as quickly as possible, recover and become capable of being part of the international system, as indeed happened in the 50s and later on. So that post-1945 strategic, geostrategic model of diplomacy as being an effort to create conditions in which you can move beyond a winner and a loser into a new arrangement which works adequately for all parties. That's the kind of thing that diplomacy is about. And finally, I think it also follows from that, diplomacy is not about the past. Diplomacy is about the future. Diplomacy is about creating and making things possible for the next decades, the next generations that have not been possible or have been undermined or wasted or spoiled by past generations. So my sense, final sentence, is that diplomacy is, if you like, a duty, or has about it a duty, to dedicate yourself to trying to create greater stability for the future than you inherit from the past. Can I stop there?
Okay, thank you very, very much indeed for that excellent presentation. We've now got about 45 minutes to deal with various issues. I think there's so much there that, and I'm sure people have got lots of questions. I think if you wouldn't mind if I abused chair's privilege to ask the first question. I mean, you know, I think one of the things that, a lot of us who are involved with Cyprus are encountering more and more, and worryingly so, is the view that, well, perhaps we should just leave things as they are. Let the island be divided. Perhaps that's best. The two communities don't want to live with each other. I mean, what sort of arguments would you give, you know, in the face of these calls, which I should also say I find worrying that I hear more and more from young people, that these are the people who people say, oh, it's the youngsters who'll find a settlement. But I find something very different. They seem disillusioned. They don't have much interaction with each other. So what would you be saying to people when they put that view to you?
I mean, It's right to ask the question, what would you say to the younger generation? The younger generation have not known anything except the status quo in practice. It's only the old ones who remember what it was like before, who can be motivated to try to get back to anything like that. And I think for the next generation, you have to talk not just about economic opportunity, not just about the chance to create a Cyprus which can make a positive contribution to the stability and prosperity of its region, which is a responsibility that Cyprus, as now an EU member state, ought to be taking seriously. Not just about the chance to catch up with those areas of social and economic evolution which I mentioned earlier, which have fallen behind, but to avoid some of the vulnerabilities that come with an island that is divided into two very small, by global standards, entities that suffers and will increasingly suffer from the lack of it's not specifically a lack, but it's a sort of it's a handicap by not enabling itself to apply its assets, its strengths, its initiative single-mindedly to finding a place for itself in the 21st century. I come back to the point, it's about creating a future which you hope the next generation will see as interesting. It's not about recreating the past that they've been told about by their grandparents. Tiny story, but I think it's kind of relevant here. I met, quite by chance, a few months ago, a family, Greek Cypriot family, who had a house in Kyrenia, and the grandparents had to flee. And they had talked throughout the years to their children and then their grandchildren about how wonderful the house had been and how splendid their life had been. And then eventually the day came when they could, and they did, go back to visit it after the crossing points were opened. And the teenage grandchildren, who'd been brought up with the idea of this house for so many years, were part of the carload, and they went. And they said nothing. The grandchildren said absolutely nothing. And the parents and grandparents were excited and moved and in some cases shocked. And the grandchildren still said nothing. Until later that evening, over supper in the family, the 16, 17-year-old boy broke his silence and said, in English, "Is that all it was?" And I think it's really important, to go back to your question, that the case for settlement needs to be made to the next generation in terms which don't look back to re-establishing something from the past, but promising a new kind of Cyprus which can become possible in the future.
Thank you very much. I'll be keeping an eye out for anyone who wants to ask a question. If you could perhaps just identify yourself as well and just state any affiliation. Lady just there. Thank you.
Hi. So my name is Penelope. Thank you. So my name is Penelope. I'm a Greek Cypriot, and I'm here for my master's degree. I'm a postgraduate law student. And since the topic today is about the settlement, maybe possible solution, I would like to ask, in the case that a solution and a common ground is being found, do you believe that the British base back in Cyprus will still be there, will still exist in the island? And if yes, why?
I suppose part of the answer is, I think that the first part of the answer is yes. It may look different. It may not be as big. We have said, as you know, that if it helps to make a settlement possible, we would be ready to transfer nearly half of it, or them. I think also the relationship between it, them, and a new Cyprus could look very different. I think that the potential impact of the existence of British bases in the context of a new Cyprus could, if we get it right, make a contribution to the successful implementation of a new settlement. And I think by doing so, if we can get it right, it could foster a different kind of understanding of what it means to Cyprus to have the bases present on the island. But I think that it's important not to start from the assumption that the bases are there because there is a problem. The bases were there already from independence as part of the 1960 settlement. There are all sorts of different views that people can have about whether or not or how far they have helped or not helped over the years, and that's a perfectly fair line of questioning if you want to go there. But I think it would be a pity, and not necessarily a constructive thing, to assume that a settlement needed to envisage the removal of the bases, because I think they can be more of a positive factor than that.
I have Jonathan now.
Jonathan Isle from the Royal United Services Institute. I want to take you to the second half of the title of the presentation, namely the developments in UK-Cyprus relations. Now, you said the relations have probably now the best that they've been since independence, and you gave a sort of almost a sort of communist style statistics, you know, volume matters more than value. So 90%. Let me ask you about perhaps the 10% that still needs fixing. Do we share the same view of Russia and Russia's footprint in Europe today? And do we share the same view about this sort of trilateral Israel, Greece, Cyprus budding relationship? And if we don't, do we engage in a dialogue about this that is constructive, or we just ignore each other?
Mm.
Two different questions. I think as far as the new fashion of trilateralism is concerned, Cyprus clearly believes that this is a really important development in their foreign policy. They put a lot of effort into creating these relationships, some of them bilaterally, some of them trilaterally. And I think it's really for them and the other partners involved to start to prove that they are capable of being as weighty, as substantive as they like to suggest. I'm not saying that they can't be, but I think it's now is the moment. They've set up some of these things to show that they can work. And if they can work, if they can create kinds of contact and kinds of reinforcement that don't currently exist, or they can strengthen them, that's a good thing. So I think I wouldn't, I'm not sceptical, I'm not doubtful, I'm just waiting to see whether the initial effort that has been put in to create some of these relationships can start to deliver the kind of results that they claim for them. And I hope they can. As far as Russia's concerned, no, I don't think quite that the view of Russia in Nicosia is the same as the view in London. And there are a whole range of reasons why that might be so. It's interesting that Limassol now is said to have the largest Russian community outside the Russian Federation. And in a city which is absolutely not the largest city outside the Russian Federation. So they have a kind of a visibility in Limassol, particularly, but also elsewhere, which is quite striking. They have been there now long enough to establish themselves as a community with their own radio stations, their own schools, their own newspapers, now their own political party as well, which is interesting. I think it's true that the current Cyprus government sees that is a development that needs to be watched quite carefully, and sees that the dilemmas that can possibly come with it are serious ones and difficult ones, coming on top of the involvement of Russian capital in the banking sector, on top of the grant of Cypriot citizenships to Russian investors, something like 55%, I think, of all the citizenships that have been granted under this investment scheme have gone to Russian citizens. They are, the Cyprus government, I think, more uneasy about some of the choices that this means they have to make than certainly the previous government, and they have tried in some cases to resist Russian ambitions for facilities, for accesses of various kinds. But I think it's unrealistic, to be honest, if in London we assume that Cyprus's engagement with Russia can ever be as, if you like, distant, as remote, as hands-off as is possible for some other EU member states, because they do need Russian economic engagement in their economy. After the British tourists, the Russians are the second biggest category now, and then then there are the residents and the financial services involvement. The sensible thing, and I think to some extent it's what not just the UK but EU member states in general have been doing, is to encourage Nicosia to recognise that there are dilemmas to be confronted, and that in cases like sanctions policies, there are disciplines that need to be observed by EU member states, and to help and encourage them to find solutions to those dilemmas which can keep the Russians from expecting too much. Is that all right?
That's scary.
Thank you very much. My name is Irene Martin. I'm from the Autonomous University of Madrid, but currently visiting fellow at the Hellenic Observatory. And I usually do electoral studies, and you mentioned voters more than once, and I'm very interested in hearing more about how you see the interaction between a possible settlement and electoral or party politics, because it could be that a settlement is not profitable in electoral terms, and for a diplomat that is quite a challenge. So any views that you may have on that would be very interesting.
Okay,
thank you.
I'll offer you two thoughts. And the first is kind of a simple one in a sense. The outcome of the presidential elections in February and the outcome of the elections that the Turkish Cypriots had the month before both suggested that voters are broadly positive to the continuing attempt to find a settlement on the traditional lines. So that's an encouraging thing. But the second thought I would offer is that I always sensed a greater divorce between politicians' discourse about settlement and the kind of conversations that you would have in Cyprus with non-politicians on the subject of settlement than I think you tend to find elsewhere, or than is healthy. And I think that part of the reason for that is this long-standing temptation by some of the politicians to present options to voters which aren't realistic, which don't get achieved, and which therefore build a risk of cynicism, which, as you say, can potentially undermine the chances of winning support for a settlement, if indeed one can be negotiated. And I think it's a real responsibility for political classes in general not to talk about settlement and the choices that have to be made and the angles that have to be agreed and negotiated in ways which go too far away from what seems to be a continuing broad, general, non-specific voter appetite to have a settlement to vote on. Does that make any sense?
Representative from the High Commission.
Ah!
My name is Solon Sava, I'm the Deputy High Commissioner, Cyprus High Commissioner here in London. Can you hear me, first of all?
Yep. Don't know if it's
to the mic. Is that okay? Yeah. How about now?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Matthew, thank you very much for the interesting and, in some respects, quite different let's say, presentation that you made today, especially on the settlement issue. You very carefully steered away from trying to pass on any kind of blame on either of the two sides for where we are right now, which I think many of us here know where the situation is and how we ended up here. But there are various, obviously, interpretations, and obviously it's good that you basically steered away from that. However, we are at a critical point now in Cyprus on where things will go. Obviously, there are many things on the table. Maybe continue from where we left off, maybe the Guterres plan, maybe draw a different line, maybe go towards a different kind of thinking or a different process. You have a new High Commissioner in Cyprus. What would the advice, your advice, be to him on, you know, where he can start as far as thinking on how we can get back on the negotiating table? That's the question. As far as the bilateral situation and relationship is concerned, I just want to say that I completely agree with your assessment. I think we have made quite some big strides in the last few years, and I would probably point a little bit more towards the 2013 period onwards. Obviously, the NMD agreement, the non-military development of the base agreement, was a huge step towards that direction. I would like to say that we have some step back sometimes, especially in the use of the bases, with more recently, what happened with Syria, of course, and the hit there. But obviously, I think there is a recognition and an awareness from the UK and from us that we need to cooperate more on that. And I think this is the key issue in the relationship, that there is an awareness that we need more cooperation on the basis, and I think we have achieved that. A very quick point on Russia, you put it very eloquently. I just would like to say that besides the financial, which is obviously a big thing for us, there are two more reasons. One is obviously, and people need to understand that there is a cultural and a historical, there are cultural and historical ties to Russia. We go back ages, and I think there is a proximity there for us. But also, we have to not forget that Russia is a P5 member, and obviously with the Cyprus question still unresolved, the members of the Security Council are important for us to give a close and a good relationship with them. Thank you.
The cultural relationships of the Romania are no different from the cultural relationships of Cyprus as far as history is concerned. The reaction of the two countries to Russia is completely the opposite. So history is very little to do with it, unless you are.
Jonathan, we're not going to hold your horses. No, I'll jump in next if you're not careful on this one. Matthew.
What would I advise my successor? It's kind of interesting to be asked to do that by the Cyprus High Commission in full view of everybody else. I think what I would advise him to do, indeed I have, is to take his time to listen and learn, not arrive looking as though he thinks that Britain knows what the answers are. Bit by bit, I expect, his experience will be the same as mine, which was that as you build up your credibility as someone who understands and cares, you can start to make a difference. You can start to convey messages, you can start to offer suggestions, you can start to challenge a bit sometimes. But if you start to do that straight away, then it doesn't really work very well. That's not what there is an automatic market for a British High Commissioner in Cyprus to do.
Gentleman there.
Hello, my name is Sergen Mahçeci. I'm a PhD student here at LSE. My question is on diplomacy, but I'll eventually ask an undiplomatic question. Your 4 points on diplomacy, I think, were like quite illustrious and eloquent expressions of pragmatism and stoicism as well, because you talked a lot about cynicism. But my question is, wouldn't your advice that Cypriots should be future-oriented, wouldn't that sound a little bit insulting, perhaps, to some Greek Cypriots, especially those who still self-define as grandchildren of refugees? And I'm asking this as a Turkish Cypriot myself. And how would you respond to a Greek Cypriot insulted by your pragmatism, first of all as a diplomat and secondly as a human being, I guess?
Absolutely. The human pain which so many Cypriots have faced, or their parents or grandparents have faced in the years since independence, is a fact and needs to be respected. And nothing that I've suggested about the need to look forward implies that the history of the past should just be wiped away. But I think the combination of respecting that those hurts from the past plus looking constructively at what you can do in the future to create a better Cyprus where the same hurts have less risk of recurring is the right combination, which I hope would prevent anyone feeling that I am insulting them.
Gentleman just behind him.
Hello, my name is Alexandros Zachariadis. I am a postgraduate student in the International Relations Department here at the LSE. And there's a lot being said on the Cyprus dispute. I would like to ask a question regarding our bilateral relations. So with Brexit being a few years away at best, do you think that the framework that existed prior to Cyprus's accession in the EU is enough to keep these bilateral relations that you have commented as being highly positive?
No, I think we can do better than that.
Okay.
I think the experience that we've had over 15 years nearly of being EU partners together has created habits and assumptions about each other which are better than what there was before Cyprus acceded. And I hope we can avoid falling back to that. There will be a lot of specific technical stuff that we need to get agreed to make a reality of that in all sorts of fields, starting, I guess, with the effect of Brexit on the Cypriots living here, on the British expatriates living in Cyprus, and all the other aspects of the Brexit negotiations as they apply to the two countries in question. But I definitely don't think that we need to fall back on the much thinner and pricklier relationship that we had then. I think we can expect and work towards a much more constructive future than that. Not least because we, the UK, will continue to have a very direct interest in how the EU continues to evolve after we've left it, and we will need to encourage like-minded EU member states like Cyprus to continue to argue for the sort of things that we and they have been arguing for alongside each other up to now. We will still hope that the EU evolves, for instance, as a global, liberal, outward-facing, rules-respecting economic actor in the world. and we will want to encourage member states who see it like that as well, including Cyprus, to speak up for it, filling the void that the absence of our voice will leave from that kind of discussion. So that will provide, if you like, an interesting new dynamic. We will be asking Cyprus to do something for us in a way that hasn't traditionally been much of a factor. They will be able to tell us to get lost if they don't like it. So it will be a different kind of relationship, but I certainly don't think it needs to be to go back as far as what we used to have before 2004.
Gentlemen here.
My name is Theo Theodorou. I represent the organization Lobby for Cyprus. The responsibility of the United Kingdom, I think that's very important because since 1878, uh-huh. back to 1878, I think UK has benefited a lot from Cyprus, if we talk strategically, militarily wise, and so forth. But you were focusing a lot on diplomacy, mentioning about how the Greek Cypriots and the political party should be diplomatic in the way that they would progress with any solution to a settlement. But you didn't mention anything about Turkey and how Turkish diplomacy in the region should be influenced by the United Kingdom and other Western mm-hmm. and other states. And I think I would like your views on that as well. My second question is the EEZ. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, but we feel that's a third invasion by Turkey into our exclusive economic zone. And they know what they're doing politically and diplomatically for that. What are your views as far as the Greek Cypriot president and his policy should be in using that as a tool and a diplomatic tool in order to be able to move towards a settlement? And finally, I have just
really,
one more.
Just cool.
I have 22 questions, but I'll stick to...
third is your last.
My last. I know.
Choosing your top three.
My top three. Turkish Cypriots, and I'm glad certain Turkish Cypriots are here. They are now a minority in the occupied part, and we know that. And we were talking about voting and the future referendum that will come. And we feel that the colonization of the occupied area is having effect on the Turkish Cypriots as well. And we're hearing that, obviously. It's not the Turkish Cypriots' views that will determine the settlement. It is Turkey and its objectives as far as the occupied north is concerned. Thank you.
Okay, just one tiny correction before I start answering your questions.
Yes.
I deliberately didn't talk in terms of Greek Cypriot politicians and what they were saying. I talked in terms of Cypriots because I think that the things that I was saying apply to both. It wasn't a specifically Greek Cypriot point, but your three questions are important ones.
Thank you.
Nobody is in any doubt about the role and influence of Turkey on the settlement process. Nobody is in any doubt that Turkey needs to be part of achieving any settlement. One of the things that was encouraging, to some extent, about the Swiss experience last year, if you like, was that Turkey was ready to come and engage seriously for the first time in the discussions that started there. They weren't effectively concluded, but they started there, in particular on the topic of security and guarantees, which had never been discussed before. There are all sorts of views that one can have about how far they went, whether they went as far as they could have, whether they went as quickly as they could have, and so on. But they did engage. They were part of it. And I think that was a really important part of the progress that I referred to earlier, that it would be nice not to lose. They need to be helped to believe that a settlement is in their interests too, in the context of all the other diplomatic and other strategic challenges that they face in the region. And one of the things that I think we, the UK, would claim we have really worked at in recent years is using the credit, such as it is, that we have in Ankara to make those points to them, to try to get them to see that they have an interest in achieving a settlement too. I can't say that it has worked. I can't say that it has been, you know, just turned the light on, but I think it is a contribution that we have made that is positive and has been at least a force in the right direction. On the question of hydrocarbons, I was wondering when that would come up. It was bound to. To be honest, I think we have to start that discussion from a step or two further back. One of the things that I've learnt about the gas business since the first discoveries were made in Aphrodite in 2011 is that gas from the Eastern Mediterranean, from Cypriot fields, from Israeli fields, from wherever, is going to be deep. And therefore, it is going to be relatively expensive to bring to the surface. And the chances are, as far as one can see, that over the next 20, 25 years, there will be more than enough gas being extracted around the world to meet expected demand. So it will be a buyer's market. And the thing about gas, which is different from oil, is that you can't store it. Once you've got it out of the ground, or wherever it is, you've got to get it to its end destination straight away. So Cyprus, and indeed Israel, and indeed Egypt, need to be sure that they have buyers for their gas in mind, signed up, before they start to extract it from the sea. And they need, in practice, to be as sure as they can be that having paid the extra premium because their gas is deep to get it to the surface in the first place, they don't load further premiums onto their produce, which will make it less competitive in the world market. And that sequence, that kind of combination of commercial, technical, political factors is, in the end, going to be more important to determining whether gas from the Eastern Mediterranean can be all that we want it to be in terms of an incentive, in terms of an economic stimulator and so on, than focusing specifically now on the rights and wrongs of the EEZ. It's a frustrating thing to have to say, and it goes back, in a sense, to what I was saying earlier about the role of diplomacy being to take over from the point where international law can take you no further. So I believe that there is a significant prospect that gas from the Eastern Mediterranean can work as a win-win, if you like, both for Cyprus and for Turkey and for Israel and the other countries in the region, provided that they find ways to address it constructively together. But if that collaboration cannot happen, for reasons which one can perfectly understand, then the risks are that the political extra marginal cost of getting it out will make it harder to find a market for, will make it more likely that nobody gets the benefit for it. It's not for me to say how you do that, but I think that to answer your question, how can Anastasiades, President Anastasiades, use it as a positive factor? The answer is that it can only serve as a positive factor for anybody long term if ways are found to address it collaboratively. How you do that, what kind of structures you set up, how you get from the present state to something where the parties involved feel they can collaborate effectively on it, is a really difficult thing, and I don't underestimate that at all. But long term, I'm certain that it's only going to be the choice is between win-win or lose-lose. There are no alternative options which can benefit one party but not others. And your third question, Turkish Cypriots. I think we need not to fall into assuming that people who come from Turkey to settle with the Turkish Cypriots remain, if you like, wired as Turks. They wouldn't come to Cyprus in the first place unless they saw their future as being there. And that applies even more so to the next generation, the children that they have who grow up in Cyprus, who know no other home, who work there, who in turn then have a third generation. And the voting results in 2004 didn't suggest that the settlers resisted the Annan plan. So I don't think we need to assume that settlers again would instinctively vote against a new settlement if it can be reached. They will need, like anybody else, to feel that it is in their interest too. But the fact that they have come to Cyprus, made their lives in Cyprus, shown presumably they want to make their lives in Cyprus, is going to mean they have a different perspective on it from maybe what they would have had before they came to Cyprus in the first place, and certainly different from the perspective of the political parties in Turkey. I mean, it's an assumption not to fall into. That's not to say that they are necessarily going to support any settlement that comes their way. No, of course not. But they're going to approach it not with a Turkish mindset, but with an ex-Turkish now living in Cyprus mindset. And that's something that creates an opportunity for the politicians, if we can get to the stage where there is a settlement, to design arguments for them too, to convince them that it is worth voting and supporting.
It has been a structured demographic move by Turkey.
That I think is not as clear as you say. I think probably in the 70s, yes, there was at that stage a structured move, but I don't think it's like that now.
I would recommend, there's been a lot of very interesting work by the PRIO Cyprus Centre on this, and Mete Hatay, who's done. We're almost out of time. I'm going to allow one more question. If you could make it really quick, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
I will try to make it very quick. My name is Dilşat Şenol. I am an political officer in the representative office of Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus. You have described us the relations between the United Kingdom and the Cyprus, but I assume that the Cyprus you were mentioning was the Republic of Cyprus, because in general we heard about the how the relations would be after Brexit, and the relations as the European Union member countries in general. So, as you know, the Aki is suspended in the north by the Protocol 10, so we're not a part of the European Union. So can you please describe us how the relations of the United Kingdom and Turkish Cypriots? And my last bit question is, this gentleman here just described us as minority in Cyprus. So as far as I know and everybody knows, we are working towards a settlement for a federal settlement as equal partners. So do you agree with this comment?
The minority of Turkish Cypriots in the occupied part, not as far as the Turkish
part. It's not an occupied part.
Yeah, and it's not an occupied part.
No, we've done really well till now, all right. Can we just sort of just, we're almost out of time. Matthew has really very kindly, so I'll give him
much.
The final
Thank
word
you.
On this. Thank you.
I think it doesn't make sense to be too specific, quite honestly. We have, as you know, relations of lots of kinds with Turkish Cypriots, and that applies now, and it will apply after Brexit. It's not that Brexit applies only in one part of Cyprus. Of course, it isn't. But you know as well as I do the background to the kinds of relationship that we have, and you know the kinds of business that we do with Turkish Cypriots in different ways. Some of that will be indirectly affected by Brexit. More of it will not.
On that note, I'm really...
Let's have one last one, because let's not make that the last question.
Right. Is that fair? Thank you very much. It's very timely.
Make it a quick one, though.
I think it's going to be a very, very quick one. So, Ivana is with you from Global IFS, the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
I'm sorry. So my question has to do with the good commitment that you talked about at the beginning of your presentation. So I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on the definition. So what does it entail, good commitment? How do you see the current UK commitment in Cyprus? What is its nature?
In relation specifically to the search for a settlement, I think that we were quite successful in a cautious kind of way over the last 3, 4, 5 years in winning the trust of all the actors involved that we were, if you like, friends of the process. We were not there to try to impose our view of what the answer should be, but we were there to try to help achieve an answer that was acceptable to the others. And on the basis of that, we were able to, if you like, lubricate the effort. We were able, alongside the UN very often, but also using assets of our own, to help explain, to correct misunderstandings, to create new ideas, to offer suggestions, to challenge misunderstandings, to challenge misconceptions, to use our access in Ankara and Athens and elsewhere as well, to try to help narrow the gaps, identify where there could be ways forward. And I think that in Switzerland last year, we didn't get to the end of the story, but I think we can claim that some of the progress that was made in Geneva and Montpellier and then in Crans-Montana was thanks to the ability we had earned to get the others to trust us as seriously committed to trying to find a settlement that would work for them. And that meant that when we did, if you like, offer a view of our own, as we did in some cases, That was sometimes quite effective in helping to focus the discussion where the what they call the landing zone could be. So we were obviously working very closely with the UN, but we were in touch all the time with all the others in a way that by the end of Crans-Montana, they were better able to be in touch directly with all the others themselves as well, because they had spent all that time together. But to start with, that didn't apply. And beforehand, it certainly didn't apply. And so I think that kind of, not very glamorous, largely behind the scenes, contribution to focusing, guiding, smoothing the path of the process is a good thing for us to be doing, and one that, at the moment, nobody else can do instead of us.
Thank you very, very much, Matthew. I mean, it's been great to have you here, and you know, so pleased that you were able to find a bit of time after your stint in Cyprus to come and speak to us this evening. I really, you know, as I say, having had the privilege of seeing you working up close personal in the Foreign Office during that, and knowing your dedication to trying to take forward British Cypriot relations, and also in the course of the talks, it really was very kind of you to come here and share your thoughts with us this evening. So if we could express our appreciation in the usual way.